Hello and welcome to another episode of Education Sense, the podcast by teachers for teachers. If you're listening to this, first of all, congratulations! You have just survived the longest teaching term and also Christmas. That's an achievement in itself. My co-host David has given me a double thumbs up. I'm just surviving. I'm a little snotty and gravelly of throat, but I'm fighting the good fight. And that brings me to something about motivation. What has motivated you to keep going? Was it intrinsically wanting just to do a good job? Or perhaps it was the extrinsic satisfaction of getting that pay packet for another month? Or perhaps, probably more likely, it's a little bit of both. Anyway, today we're going to talk all about how we can do our best to motivate children at school and at home with their learning. Thankfully, it's not going to involve the PAYE scheme, but we're going to be looking at a range of ideas and methods to get the most out of our pupils. I'm here today with my co-host, David Marshall. David, hello.
Hi.
And I'm also with Ross Borthwick, who was one of the co-founders of this pod, who's come back for this episode. What a treat. Ross, thanks for coming back.
Oh, thanks for having me. Anytime.
Oh, good. Well, we might actually call you up on that one. That was a dangerous thing to say. So, before we get going, let's have a think about motivation. What does it mean? What does it look like in the classroom? It may sound like an obvious thing to talk about, but I think it's important just to give it a definition before we get going and think about what we can do to help our children have motivation.
The question is really good to ask ourselves, because you could say, what motivates me to be a teacher? What motivates me to do my work to the highest ability that I can? What motivates me to come on this podcast on a Sunday evening and talk about motivation? These are sort of all questions which I've actually been thinking about for the last few days in the lead up to this pod. And I would probably refer back to a previous podcast episode on curiosity and say, for me, I think motivation comes from a curiosity about wanting to know. I get like a thread of something, like that there's something that I'd like to build on or understand. And then I just want to follow that thread. And that curiosity, that kind of interest drives me to continue until I've found something that satisfies me. And that's me as a grown-up. I'm not reflecting on myself as a child here, but I would say it comes from some inner sense of wanting to know something or wanting to do something in that respect. Ross, what do you think?
No, I was just agreeing with you there. I think, being reflective on myself, I'm completely restless. I think my wife would agree that motivation to not only in the normal workplace, but I suppose you'd call them side hustles, just other interests, it comes from a place of curiosity. Absolutely. And I think as a pupil, if I think about my own education and the things that I was interested in at school, they varied greatly depending on how curious I was about those areas. So yeah, totally agree.
I was actually thinking back to myself as a child at school, and I was a geek. I was a hardworking geek, and I'm trying to think why I was a hardworking geek. Slightly because I wasn't very good at sport or musical art, and academics I was good at, and therefore there was an edge of wanting to be good at something, and I think I probably felt success from that. And I'm less of a thinker, I think, than you two. I'm motivated by being busy and getting things done. I did want to learn about the world, but perhaps not in the same depth as you. So it was a motivation to do well because I could do well. And also just to be engaged and busy, and success is, in my mind, was always ingrained in me about working hard, I think. That's always been something that I've aspired to do, is working hard. So I feel like a lot of us, the three of us, have actually probably all demonstrated that we are heavily motivated by this intrinsic motivation that comes from within. And that's going to be something that we're going to discuss quite a lot. David's got his little paw in the air. What do you want to say, David?
Yeah, because I'm still at a heart, a pupil as well as a teacher. So, you know, if you could see me, I've got my hand up, which I love to do. I was thinking about the things that I lose motivation to do. A few years ago, when I moved to live in Shanghai for a while, I obviously tried to learn Chinese and I tried to learn Mandarin. And I would say I failed dismally. And my Mandarin was at best taxi Mandarin. It could get me around. You know, I could order a couple of things in a restaurant, but all of that's disappeared over the last 8 years. I think that my challenge there was that I was trying to learn something which was very unfamiliar, a language which wasn't a romance language, therefore it didn't fit in any of my prior knowledge, prior learning. And even though I was living for about 18 months in China, I lost motivation to do it because I wasn't seeing the results from it. I wasn't seeing the effect of my effort that I was putting in. I couldn't sort of get beyond whatever ceiling I was trying to break to get into that place where I kind of felt like I was actually learning something. And so one thing which I think I'd like to consider in this podcast would be how motivation can be really hard for children because learning is hard. And going back to again another podcast episode we did some months ago about Daniel Willingham's Why Don't Students Like School? That book was titled that because learning is really hard. And because when children experience the difficulties of learning, it makes them want to give up because of that. And I think there's something in this about motivation. And Ross, you've got some ideas, I think.
Yeah, I think listening to what you have to say, it goes back to purpose, which is something else we've talked about in the pod as well. Because I imagine when you were out in China, let's say you wanted to order a beer. In fact, David, can you remember the Mandarin for wanting to order a beer?
Oh dear.
Wo
Probably
Yao
by the end.
Yiping, no, Wo Yao Yiping Piju. Okay, which is like one of the two stock phrases I've remembered
Did
from being around
you just
China.
look that up? Did you just
No,
look on
I
Google?
honestly, hand on heart, two sentences from my time in China. I didn't teach there, but those two sentences were really useful, so I was motivated to learn them. So there was a purpose to me learning them, but I didn't want to learn more of the language selfishly. I wasn't particularly curious about doing that. So I think for me, it's is there a point to what we're learning? And if there is, I'm more likely to retain it. And I think that's something we're probably going to explore in a bit more detail and see whether there's any truth to that.
You're right, we are going to. We'll discuss that in a bit. But we thought we'd start off by thinking about the motivation that we haven't talked about as much yet, which is this idea of extrinsic motivation. And that is these external influences which can affect motivation. So it might be more things like rewards and punishments. You know, we've got the old stickers, etc. The massive one that falls under this category, if we're thinking about extrinsic motivation, is praise and feedback. It's huge because it's probably one of the most important tools we've got in our armory, I would say. It's super simple. It's totally free. You don't have to photocopy anything. It can be verbally done. And it can be such a powerful way to motivate children. Although I have seen a really interesting article that cautions us all about overdoing praise. And I definitely do this with my children at home. And I sometimes catch myself praising them to do something that is the most basic and expected of tasks and go, oh my goodness, you have become one of those people that is praising for such a simple thing. They basically like to talk about the difference between acknowledgement of something being done and praise for something being done. And in fact, it's really standard semantics, but I love the idea that you obviously want to acknowledge when a pupil has done a basic task well. So let's take the example of lining up outside the classroom. So rather than saying, well done, Susie, you have lined up outside the classroom. That's brilliant. It's not brilliant. She's lined up outside a classroom. It's not that significant. However, to motivate her to continue to do that, you just simply need to say, thanks, Susie, for lining up outside the classroom silently. You've acknowledged she's done a good job. That's going to motivate her to continue to do a good job, but you're saving your mega praise for something that might be more significant, like using fronted adverbials in your story, or being able to recite some Shakespeare, or whatever it is that you are wanting them to do. Praise for that, acknowledge for more basic tasks. So I really like that idea about not going banana for the brilliant, fantastic, woohoo, you're amazing, but also not disregarding when pupils are doing the right thing.
I think, you know, it goes back to authenticity, doesn't it? I think if you're genuinely impressed with them, let them know. But if it's in any way false, they will see through that, and it will have the opposite effect.
There's something here also about not having low expectations of children. And that motivation factor, the praise has to be for the level that they are just reaching for. Many people will know about Carol Dweck's work on growth mindset, which has been around for quite a long time. There's a really interesting article, which is, I think the article's title is something like, "It's okay, not everyone can be good at maths." And this was a study done in 2011. Dweck was one of the kind of three people involved in the study. And it showed that when you have too much empathy in terms of a child who's struggling with maths, then it conveys low expectations to them. Whereas when you just kind of give the basic and quite simple feedback and praise, then you're actually conveying your higher expectations that this child, although they're struggling right now, with the correct step-by-step procedure, can reach success. And that in itself is really affirming for a child to know that you believe in them.
And I think doesn't that just show perfectly what an important thing personal relationships are and your understanding of the pupils in the room? Because actually, to one people, they may be struggling with something that another might find fairly rudimentary, and you need to tailor your praise accordingly.
Yes, and in fact, that is one of the other big ways of engendering this extrinsic motivation is through our relationships with the pupils. You know, one of the other points is actually if you've got a positive relationship with them, I mean, it sounds very obvious, but it's just, I suppose, important just to voice and remind us all that if you have got that positive relationship with your pupils and they feel safe and valued within your classroom setting, they're going to be so much more motivated to do well. I've certainly seen that when I've taught in the classroom with some pupils who were really struggling with their English in year seven. At the beginning of that school year, they were pretty disengaged. You know, they felt it was really hard for them. They were disengaged. They didn't listen very well. And I had to spend quite a long time creating a relationship with them to realize actually we could have some fun in the classroom. I was there to help. We had to kind of get through it together. And then suddenly their attitude towards their work really improved. And it was so satisfying to see. So, yeah, I'm a massive fan of trying to build those relationships when you can. And I know that David's had some thoughts about that as well.
Definitely. I mean, just a sort of like an anecdote from a previous school when I was coaching a teacher who was an early career teacher, new to teaching. And one thing we were working on with this teacher was getting him to have a clear entry routine. One thing I noticed that was happening was the children were coming in without an entry routine, and it was just from the get-go, the class, it didn't have any structure. So the kids would come in, and then it would take about 5 or 6 or 7 minutes before anything actually happened. Like there was no learning happening in that time. So with this teacher, we put an entry routine, which is very simple, high expectations lining up, and then coming into the classroom, and it was for a drama lesson. So it was sitting on the floor and just saying thank you to each group as they sat on the floor, ignoring the children who were off task and gradually building up this. The norm of the classroom was that you would come in, you'd sit on the floor, you'd look at the board, and you'd get ready for the classroom. And that's based on a really interesting piece of research, which you may have heard of the bandwagon effect. Have you come across that, Ross and Isabel?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
Though this actually comes from the hotel towels thing, where you go into a hotel and there's a sign saying, you know, please reuse your towel for the sake of the environment, which I think we've probably all seen. And that works quite well. What they did, there was a study in 2008, which tried to shift this on a more sort of to more sort of psychology, which is it said something like 98% of people reuse their towel. And you could probably see where we're going with this one, because when we perceive that everyone else is doing the norm, we want to be part of that norm. And so we subtly and without realizing it, we drift towards the norm. Oh yes, well, if everyone reuses their towel, I'm not going to be the odd one out. And we can reuse this. We can use this in the classroom. And, you know, we know as teachers, this is something we use all the time, which is the norms of the classroom are that you listen and that you do work hard. And if those norms are established, and if everybody feels like that's what everyone else is doing, gradually the sort of outliers start to sort of fall in line. And that's the virtuous cycle we want to create in the classroom, which absolutely, Isabel, is that extrinsic motivation, because we're reinforcing it. But it comes through positivity, and it comes through that relationship you're building with the children, and it comes through the sort of subtle praise that you're giving for the things that become routines. Actually, talking to this teacher after they'd implemented the routines for a few times, he said it was revolutionary in terms of the class. It really changed how it worked. And so it wasn't one thing, it was a combination of strategies, but it was really working on that idea of the bandwagon effect. Everybody wants to do what everyone else is doing, basically.
So on that, so I'm obviously as well as teacher, I'm a housemaster. So I'm thinking about developing boys in this case in the house. There's something we were thinking about this year, and something I tried to introduce, but I guess it didn't really have a catchy title. But the padre actually summarized it in a chapel talk towards the end of term, and I realized that that's what I've been striving for the whole of this year so far. So essentially, David, Isabel, greatest rugby team in the world. Who would you say?
New Zealand.
Don't
Yeah.
make me
So.
attempt to ask this.
So the New Zealand All Blacks, I'm biased towards. You could argue South Africa, but I'm going to tell you why the New Zealand All Blacks are just a phenomenally better side, and that they will always be so despite having a much smaller player base. It's to do with something they do at the very end before they go home after every match, and it's called cleaning the shed. And basically, it's a bit like what you're saying. There's a culture, an extrinsic sort of culture. And it's throughout the country at every level, primary school teams in changing rooms, all the way up to the actual All Black. When they're all done, they've played their match, they're changed, they might have had a couple of beers. A couple of them stick their hands up to sweep out the changing room. So they get all the mud off the floor, all the tape from people's fingers and whatnot that's been discarded. And they make sure the changing room looks as good as it did before the match. And that's at every level throughout their society. And it instills, obviously, huge self-discipline and teamwork and service, and shows leadership and all the rest of it. But it's just completely ingrained. And it's got to the point where the coach at the end of the day, doesn't need to say, "Right, boys, I need two volunteers." They just organize it themselves. And so in the boarding house, on a Sunday, we do a whole house tidy. And initially, it was quite painful. You can imagine boys at roll call would shy away from wanting to do tasks in the house. And you'd have to put a name on it. And you'd almost be looking, it almost became like a punishment, which it was never supposed to be. Whereas now we're at a point which is great. So, 11 weeks later, where the boys just automatically do it. You just hear them get the Hoover out and they're just having a go in the corridor. No one needs to say anything. It's just part of their routine. And they just do it. That's where extrinsic motivation has become internalized. And I think it's how do you get there?
Oh, Ross, I need to instigate Project Clean the Shed at home, I think. It sounds like a marvellous tool. And I guess that's also about it becoming the norm in a different way, isn't it? It's just about it becoming a habit. One thing I really want to talk about on this pod, because it seems to come up as a topic that people agree and disagree with, depending on who you talk to, is this idea of rewards and stickers, etc., and commendations. Some people love them, some people don't. I'll just put my little hand in the ring and say, no, it's my hat in the ring, not my hand in the ring, and just say that I do think they have a place. I think if a child has done a good thing, giving them a reward of that form fairly immediately after they have performed that task can be rewarding for some. I'm not saying for everyone, but I think they have a place, perhaps. But perhaps people put too much credence on them. What do we all think?
I think that they are good short-term rewards as long as they happen immediately. I think that children find it difficult to be motivated by something which is quite far in the distance. If they can see things being built up, like tallies, house points, of course, we know, or merits, however, whatever your school calls them, they work if there's a sense in which you can visibly see them being built up towards some end goal. I think that could be very good. That's obviously extrinsic motivation. But I think stickers are quite pricey and expensive. I haven't used them because once you start using them, you kind of have to keep using them. There's kind of like, well, when do you stop using stickers and when does it become intrinsic?
Yeah, so I've got a great example of that becoming pricey point. Obviously, it's age and stage appropriate, isn't it? But in our sort of junior section, so like I suppose like 12 to 15, we use stars quite heavily. So you can get stars for attainment and stars for effort, and they go on our system and they'll ping up. So as a housemaster, I'm aware when any of the boys get a star, and tutors are aware and things. And we announce at the end of term which house has the most stars. And of course, my house just were never getting announced. And so I sat down with the boys and I was like, "Look, guys, we've got the most juniors. You're bright boys. What's going on? We need to win some stars. It can't just be this other house every single time." So I incentivized it and I said, "If you get a star for effort," because I don't really care about the attainment star, but if you get a star for effort, I will give you a tuck token, and you can choose anything from the house tuck shop. Okay, you can see where this is going. So we won most stars, for the next 3 terms consecutively, and we were just getting stars all the bloody time. My email inbox was full of X got a star, X got a star. It was hilarious. And of course, the tuck shop had run dry. And I was in a situation where, how do I maintain this? Because they're clearly just showing effort in class because they want a chocolate bar at break time. And so we sort of withdrew that out of necessity, and it just became eternal glory. That was the prize for getting a star. And of course, the number of stars fell off the cliff. So I would love to know whether or not that short-term motivation, because it does work 100%, I guarantee that, whether it translates to a change in attitude, motivation, whether it ultimately has a long-term impact on the individual.
I agree with you, Ross. Your evidence would suggest it doesn't. There's also part of me as a parent that wonders, and this is a controversial thing to say, does it actually matter if it doesn't turn into intrinsic motivation? Because sometimes we've just got to get a job done. And if it's like with my daughter when I'm doing homework after school, if she can watch some TV after she's read her book and done her doodle maths, I've got the job done. She's done what was needed to be done. And in her mind, she's paid a kind of little prize for it. You're looking at the situation where you've either got a child who's going to do quite a good job and make a real effort on something, or they're not going to. I know my husband is really controversial about this. He's like, why did I go to work? I went to work because I got a really good pay packet at the end of it. That's literally the only reason I went to work, Isabel. I had no intrinsic motivation whatsoever. And you just go, well, that's how some people operate, isn't it? And actually, one of my children has got three children, and she uses extrinsic motivation for all three of them. One wants to have hard cash for doing jobs or having to do his work in the holidays. The other one wants screen time to play computer games. And then the third one does just do it for intrinsic motivation because he just wants to do it. And maybe it's a personality thing. These things are just horses for courses. David, your little hand's in the air.
We have to also be careful. I think we'll recognize that this is true from our own experience and partly from what you've said as well, Ross. Yes, I acknowledge different people have different motivators. There was a study I came across while researching for this podcast called, appropriately enough, Student Motivation and Associated Outcomes, a Meta-analysis from Self-Determination Theory 2021,
God, I can't
which
believe you read this, David. It sounds very impressive and very highbrow. Congratulations, first of all.
okay, just to say, I read the abstract. But the abstract does give, and this is a quote, it says, "Motivation driven by a desire to obtain rewards or avoid punishment, external regulation, was not associated with performance or persistence, but was associated with decreased well-being." And that's quite categorical. Now, it doesn't always lead to well-being, but we have to have one eye on those children who are extremely stressed by competition. Extremely stressed by seeing leaderboards and by seeing this sort of who got which and the small dynamics between one child and another in a classroom or in a family, and find the whole thing really quite compulsive, but also very difficult to get out of. And if we're the adult setting that up in a classroom or any other sort of way, we have to be really aware of what we're doing and that it's not leading to unhappy children, really.
Yeah, I totally agree, David. Actually, having been slightly flippant previously about the whole thing, you're absolutely right, because there is a real part of me that it's a dangerous game, the rewards system, because children mind if they've never got a commendation or house points, they notice that. And so actually, if you're using a system of commendations and rewards, you've got to be really careful that actually you find a meaningful way in some ways to reward everyone over a certain period of time. But then that's the other situation, is that children are very aware of if they're just being given a reward for the sake of being given one. So it's an extremely difficult balance to get right, in fact. You're right. And I guess it's a system that needs to be thought of and treated really carefully.
2 points. So obviously, in the adult world, we've obviously got a mental health crisis, haven't we? Probably across the globe, I suppose, where people are struggling to find purpose in their lives. And I think I'm right in saying for the first time, particularly in this country, there's been a noticeable change back to religion, and church attendance has gone up for something like the first time in 60 years, 70 years, where we've got young people just searching for something more than being a cog in the capitalist machine, essentially. And for lots, the pay packet is not enough, certainly in the long term. Going slightly back to reward in a sort of school setting, I meet with my prefect team once a week, and we have a junior of the week and a senior of the week, and we don't need to award that. It's just something that if my prefects feel that there has been something house related that's been observed by them or fed back to them, then it's a bit of a democratic process. The six of them decide, basically, and then they can announce it. And there isn't really a prize for that. It's just a big round of applause once a week in a roll call in the morning. But it's something, it's just quite a nice thing. I suppose you can't really strive for that form of reward. I mean, you could just be a really good bloke 24/7. And I don't think you could fake it either, because you couldn't just be picking up rubbish when a prefect happens to walk by. I don't think, I mean, maybe it would slip through now and again, but I think ultimately it's quite a good system. There is no actual reward. And I think maybe rewards like that, I mean, I have no actual evidence is the flip side to this, but maybe rewards like that contribute to a culture and help foster something that then becomes intrinsic.
Well, I think you're right, Ross. In my mind, what you're actually talking about is it's in fact a sense of praise, just albeit from the prefects rather than from you, perhaps in a classroom. That brings us nicely, though, on to discussing a little bit more detail the intrinsic motivation, this inner motivation that we want pupils to have, which, as we're beginning to realize, is a harder nut to crack, probably. One way that it's sort of mooted that you can do it is, I suppose, by us being the role model. And actually, I'm not going to put all the onus on us. I'm absolutely convinced that a lot of it also comes from home as well, who they see at home and within their family and friend group there. But I guess when I was thinking about this idea of being a role model within a classroom with pupils, I also thought it's perhaps important to be maybe a little bit more overt about our kind of feelings and emotions to show how we have motivation. So maybe talking more often about when we found something difficult and how we sort of persevered to try and solve the problem. So not just having it as a given that pupils are going to sort of inferentially understand that we are highly motivated people, but actually sort of talk a bit about why we are or when we are to sort of show them the way in a way. I'm not sure what you guys think about something like that.
I think when you have role models who clearly show the way, and as Isabel, as you say, with kind of the difficulties of learning and the difficulties of doing something, then it kind of makes something more explicit. I think going back to what I said at the beginning, which is that, learning is hard. There's a theorist called Bjork, not the singer, Robert Bjork, who talks about desirable difficulties. But one of the challenges is that with those things, children perceive them as being effortful and not necessarily seeing the result of the learning. So when they find something easy, they think, in terms of learning, they think that that's kind of good payoff, if you like. But if they find something hard and they don't necessarily see the immediate reward, they're going to have less motivation to continue it. So I think it does come back to talking about how learning is hard, talking about how when you put the effort into remembering something, you're going to remember it more, and modeling that for them, saying, oh, well, I failed at this, but actually I carried on and it improved and I got better at it. But also, Isabel, I'd say the role models thing is really important. And I think there's lots of these in literature. If you think of a character like Anne Shirley in Anne of Green Gables, who, despite the difficulties that life has dealt her in terms of being a foster child from a young age, she sort of, through her pretty much intrinsic goodness and ability to recognize when she's wrong and makes mistakes, shows that you can overcome difficulties and you can kind of learn from them. Or even, fables like The Tortoise and the Hare. They teach us, and they're built into our society in terms of a UK education where you learn these sorts of things. And they teach us that effort pays off, even if the sort of lazy hare lies down for a nap halfway through the race, the tortoise persists and keeps going. So I think role models come in lots of different ways, and peers as well are super important in this.
Totally agree with what you said. I think the growth mindset thing is huge. I think if you teach metacognition, within the curriculum, I think you're essentially turning on the light bulb and making them realize that actually they are masters of their own fate by a great degree, and sort of dispelling this idea that they can't improve or that they are bad in a particular subject, countering perhaps the parent and grandparent or message at home, which may be, oh, I was never very good at X. Which, as you know, is complete nonsense. Or even worse, the idea of talent. I don't know how you feel about talent, but I hate that word. Clearly, actually, hard work is much more influential. Obviously, we have a difficult line to tread, don't we? Because we want to be seen as the expert in the room. We want to be seen as not quite infallible, but we sort of want to be seen as the professional, and we want to, I suppose, have a degree of gravitas with the pupils. But at the same time, we want them to know that we are also fallible and that we can overcome our own difficulties. And so one way that that is done quite well here, I think, is through chapel talks, where members of staff are invited to speak in front of the whole school on a topic of their choice for 5 to 10 minutes. And that happens 4 days out of 6. And that is really good because it sort of allows everyone in the room to discover that these people who they might just see as a physics robot or whatever, or a top athlete or whoever, was in fact at one time someone that struggled with something and may have overcome it. I think that human side and the ability to convey that in an appropriate way is quite important. But then I think finally, and it's perhaps easier for me in this setting, but I see a lot of the boys and girls, but particularly the boys in my house, I see a lot of them. I was sitting in a waiting room the other day and I worked out that we do, so as an HM here, you do 86 hours a week. And they are aware of that, and so they see that you are working hard. They see that you dress well. They see that you care about what you're doing, that you have pride in your work, that you formulate everything before you do it or say it, and they see how you interact with others, and they perhaps try and replicate that. So I think there's got to be something in that in terms of role models. And, whilst as an individual teacher in a school, you might not be everyone's role model, you'll certainly be the role model for quite a few people. And, across that whole staff room, there'll be a role model for everyone in the school, I'm sure.
I think you're absolutely right, and that's a lovely idea that different pupils will have different role models. I do also want us, as I said briefly mentioned, it's not all the onus on a teacher. There's a huge amount that has to go on at home as well. And actually, one thing I've thought of, because I like to spend a bit of the pod thinking about, okay, well, we are doing a podcast for teachers, but I am a parent. What insights do I have that could help a teacher become a better teacher because of that particular function I also have? And for me, I feel that teachers also have a role to be talking to parents about what they can do at home to motivate their children. Because actually, a lot of parents don't know what to do and don't do the right thing. A classic example is my husband, who, until I sort of started bugging and nagging him, is that he would praise for outcome, not for effort. Because actually, as a society, if you don't know, that's often what you end up doing. Wow, that's an amazing picture. Or wow, this is a, well done, that's fantastic, you've won the match. And actually, it spent a long time saying you have got to praise for effort, not for outcome, which was sort of new news to him. And then I suppose there are all sorts of other ideas of how teachers can also inform parents. Homework's another one, something that children are not very motivated to do, but really do need to do. And helping parents know how to overcome those battles with very simple tips, like do it as soon as you come through the door, then give them a reward afterwards. Don't give them the dopamine hit of any screen and then ask them to do homework. Or actually, recognize you've got a child that gets really tired after school, particularly if they're young. Do it in the morning. I spent virtually the entire of my first child's year of reception and year one getting her to read in the car on the way to school, because she was too tired to do it after school. Also, I think, again, on homework, another one that really I think is so important for teachers to talk to parents about is how long a child should be doing on a homework, making sure that homeworks feel valuable and useful and purposeful, and making them not too open-ended or giving a specific time allowance for them to get done. So I feel like there's also an education job that could make teachers' lives easier by educating parents about how they can help at home, because it can't all be on the school and on teachers. It has to be thrown a little bit onto parents as well. But they often don't know, and they need to be informed, I think, personally.
I think that where you have someone like yourself, Isabel, or yourself, Ross, who are both parents and teachers, or parents and in the education world, then I think you're perfectly placed to understand the difficulties of home life and the sort of picking up children and getting them to this club and getting homework done and getting to bed on time and all of those things. What I have to always remind myself as a teacher without children is just, I'm seeing the tip of the iceberg when the children come in, and there's so much that the parents are having to do, having to work with in their own lives, and that let alone with their children at home, to get them to the place where they can do all the things that we expect of them and be there with the right things. So it's kind of having that balance of giving those tips, as you say, but also understanding the challenges that are there. That sounds like a great place that I think schools can do that. I think maybe in the UK we are quite good at this in all different types of schools that I've been involved in. I know that in some countries like France, there's quite a lot more separation between the home life and the school life, and they very much exist on these kind of separate planes where the child comes into school, they learn, and then they go home and they do their own thing, their own clubs or whatever it is that not really has anything to do with school. So I kind of feeling we're sort of working with the tide in our settings to a certain extent, and I'm sure we could always do more with that.
No, I think that's right. And I think it is about being collaborative. I'm sort of totally changing subjects now, but I think it's another important one to think about building this intrinsic motivation. There are some various ways we can motivate the children and pupils by our planning, our curriculum. Are we going to be having a curriculum that piques curiosity and interest? Is it relevant to them? Does it have value? Does it feel what they should be doing? Do we give them any autonomy at points so that they can have control and choice? All these things are, again, a bit like the praise thing. It's simple, it's free. But again, if done well, it can motivate them enormously. I mean, certainly my daughter this term has been in her STEM lessons designing a chocolate bar. I mean, literally, if you're seven, what more could you possibly want to be doing in your STEM lessons other than designing a chocolate bar? But of course, it covers off so many amazing skills. Yet by the fact it's done through a chocolate bar, it immediately piques their interest and feels really exciting. So I'm like, well done, school. That's awesome. Ross.
Yeah, I mean, I feel really strongly about that. I think, as you know, on previous episodes, and from speaking to you before, the ICB IPQ, is a classic opportunity for pupils to fire their interest. Here, we've got something called real world learning. So a colleague of mine leads on something that sits outside of the curriculum, but then it has a sort of project based learning day once every term for different age groups, principally sort of further down the school. But that's all. It tends to be all STEM related stuff, and then it will build the interest of the pupils in those subjects, is the idea. So I think, again, it goes back to purpose. And I wonder just if you were to, I don't have any research on this, but if you were to go into a classroom at a different stage and say the same thing, if we were to jump into let's say, a year 10 biology lesson and just say, right, if you fail your GCSE next year, you can't be a vet. And I wonder whether that would influence any pupils in the class. And then if you were to jump down much lower down the school, let's say into a year five, and say the exact same spiel, I wonder whether that would have any form of impact on their motivation in that subject. I suppose if they saw the link between it and the real world, as opposed to it just being some content that they're studying in isolation. David.
I think that the real world application is really important. What we were saying at the beginning about our motivations as adults is that kind of idea of curiosity, of following a thread, of you said, Ross, you have all these projects that you kind of want to sort of engage with. And when I think about what works for children, it's that word purpose really comes back to it. What is it that they're doing that's going to feel satisfying because they do it, not because they're getting a sticker or even getting praise, but just feel satisfying because it's the sense of a job well done? That's the kind of thing that no matter what happens in the working world, whether AI or other things happen, is always going to be valued by an employer. And also, the something that we know about work is that even in education, a lot of things are project-based. You have a project, you work on it, you complete it, you do a good job, and you feel satisfied. And then maybe there's a moment of kind of celebrating that, but you quickly move on to the next project. And there has to be a continual motivation to enable you to go into the next project with that sense of purpose and knowing that whatever you do here is going to be, again, as good as what you did before. We can model that in school in small ways. I think performing arts and the arts generally is such a crucial way in which purpose is visible. When a child does a nativity play or when they do an end of term assembly or something like that, they're sort of visibly showing what they've done. And that ability to stand up on stage and perform is, it's actually assessment, I believe. It's a form of assessment, but it's not sitting down there and doing standardized tests. It's actually showing that you have learned something and everyone can sit there and watch you and applaud. And at the end, you don't need to get an A. You just know that it's great what you did. I mean, we had a poetry club recently, and I had a year three join the club who hilariously joined because his mum misread the club as being pottery. And he'd never done poetry really before. He'd done it a bit in class in year two, but it wasn't something he'd ever thought of doing. So for a full on 12 weeks, he ended up in my poetry club. And at the end, we put on a performance for the parents of all of the poems that we'd, well, not all of them, but some of the poems we'd written. And he started off the event. And he just was incredible. I mean, he was amazing. So at the end, everyone applauded, they went away. And then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to send an email to all the parents saying, by the way, they've got their book, their workbook. Maybe they could write some poems if they want themselves, not in the club. So Thursday, I saw his mum on the gate and she said, he started writing poems of his own accord, not because I tell him to. So we're talking about a child quite young who didn't have an appreciation of poetry before, but because he experienced success and visible success in it, and that people appreciated what he'd written, now has an intrinsic motivation to go forward and write poetry. And that sense of purpose is, I think, what we want to be fostering in children.
Well, firstly, congratulations, because he was thinking about throwing plates and in the end throwing some words around, quite different things. Secondly, your example of the performing arts is spot on, I think, because we've just had a musical performed here. Now, 2 weeks into rehearsing a play, the cast were told, and it was a diktat, that they were in fact going to perform a musical. And so the entire cast had to, I suppose, rejig things. And you've got people who perhaps weren't so interested in singing, then obviously having to perform several songs. And I went along to one of the performances, and it was absolutely sensational, like absolutely phenomenal. And I think the show wasn't recorded. It was performed for 3 evenings, and it was like a West End show. And the boys just, oh, honestly, they were incredible. And yeah, you could say some of them, juniors, wanted to try for, if you were being cynical, you could say they wanted a drama scholarship, which is then, a percentage off fees, or it looks good on their CV, or they want to apply for this. Or, of course, you can always say those things. But ultimately, that was a one-off live performance, and they put their all into it, and they rehearsed for months, and you just think, once you've got to that point where they're willing, they're that into something, that they're willing to do that for, on the face of it, no reward, then you've achieved your goal. And our head of drama is just phenomenal at doing that. So yeah, completely agree.
Well, Ross, I think that's a good anecdote for us to start wrapping this party up on, because I'm beginning to think that we should be doing musicals of times tables, or whether a noun is a and what a verb is. I feel like we could really kind of get them motivated to learn those times tables if we made it into a musical, because it sounds like it worked to get the motivation out of your pupils. Ross has got one more thing
Sorry,
to say.
sorry, I did have a second part to that, and that
Oh,
is that,
act two.
very good. So
Thanks.
the second part to that, sorry, act two, is that my daughter is performing on, I think, Tuesday this week, and she has been banging out the Christmas carols, and I mean loud and proud, strong and wrong. I'm going to hear her from the back of the room. Why has she been doing that? Well, you could argue it's because her headmaster of the entire school goes down to the nursery every Monday and operates their music lesson, runs their music. He's a member of the Royal Scottish Conservatoire. He's a very accomplished musician. You could say he motivates them, he gets them going, and they love it. Or you could say it's because from day dot, she's been going to music lessons, inverted commas, where they learn rhythm and they get to hit things with sticks and they get to sort of prance around the room with an equally enthusiastic teacher. And so, my wife's relatively musical, but, is it genetics or is it what is it? And I think there's definitely a science to the idea that for music, it's building rhythm from an early age has spillover to everything else. So I think you could be really analytical and you could look at every subject area and identify what it is that they could do to then build that intrinsic motivation, because she has absolute joy when it comes to singing anything, for sure. Or is it that it's the people that she's met along the way?
Ultimately, I think what we're saying is that a mindset that is about motivation reframes difficulties and challenges as something that's fun. And we can learn from very young children because, generally, in general, I think they do go into things not almost seeing the difficulties, but seeing how fun things are. And a good education promotes and encourages that. And then they are going to hit those difficult spots where they have to learn something hard. But if you do it in the right way, if you frame it the right way, and if we provide that support pastorally that they need going forward in whatever things that we need to do, then we just get them over the hump and onto the next level to the kind of end goal which we are looking at, which is inner purpose. And I think we are talking here not just about motivation in school, but we're talking about, I think, the secret to happiness, really, because that we want children to be accomplished, we want them to get good grades, and we want them to be fantastic artists or sort of musicians. But ultimately, what all parents and what all teachers want for the children they teach is to be happy and purposeful as they move through their education and into their post-education life.
I think that's a really great place to finish this podcast. It was beautifully put, David. Thank you. And I wonder if we've motivated you to get to the end of this podcast. Who knows? Maybe you only got halfway through. If you got to the end, well done. Have a reward, maybe a sticker. So it just leaves me to say thank you so much to David and Ross for being here this evening, and to say goodbye from me, Isabel Rich. You've been listening to Education Zents, the podcast by teachers for teachers. Thanks very much.